Hello, my name's Dave Emery. This is For the Record Program 229, and in the next 2 half-hour segments, we're going to update a subject that we've been covering for quite some time, on and off, namely Eurofascism, the growth and rise of fascism in various European countries. We're going to start with an article from the British anti-fascist publication The Searchlight. This is from The Searchlight's issue of March of the year 2000, number 297. The Searchlight can be reached at number 37B as in boy, New Cavendish Street, London, WC1M8JR. Their website is at www.s-light.demon.co.uk, and they can be emailed at editors@s-light.demon.co.uk. And the Searchlight's issue of March of 2000 has an article by Nick Lowles, L-O-W-L-E-S, and Steve Silver. It's entitled, Austria's Problem is Europe-Wide, and it's about the rise of Eurofascism. It reads, the incorporation into the Austrian government of Jörg Haider's Freedom Party is the latest development in a process that has seen the rise of racist, right-wing nationalist forces across Europe. Until an internal split in 1998, the Front National regularly gained 14% in French elections. In Belgium, the Flams Bloc is the largest single party in Antwerp. In Germany, the far right polled over 2 million votes at the last national election. Even in Britain, where the Nazi right is minuscule compared to most European countries, the British National Party polled over 100,000 in last year's European elections. Most significantly, though, this is not the first time an extreme right party has tasted governmental power in Europe recently. In Italy, the heirs of the fascist dictator Mussolini shared political power between 1994 and 1996, and today still receive over 10% in elections. By the way, the Alleanza Nazionale, the National Alliance, the party of Gianfranco Fini, the party alluded to in that particular passage, had a coalition government with Silvio Berlusconi of the P2 Lodge. Berlusconi is looming large on the Italian political horizon and may very well rise to power again later on this year. We're going to be talking about that in the second half of this program. Continuing with this article, disenchantment with the European Union and a perceived weakening of national sovereignty have also allowed right-wing, single-issue, anti-EU parties to grow. For example, despite the decline in the Front National vote, the nationalist anti-EU party led by Charles Pasqua and Philippe Duvillier gained 13% in the European elections. In the same elections in Britain, the UK Independence Party won 3 seats with over 700,000 votes. The rise of nationalism in Europe started with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the communist bloc in the late 1980s and has gathered pace throughout the past decade. Post-war European society, and probably the whole world, had been conditioned by the Cold War, the battle between communism and capitalism. Political identities were shaped by the question of which side was to be supported in the East-West conflict. Consequently, national feelings were to a large extent suppressed. The collapse of communism has shattered the old certainties. Old battles and ethnic feuds, which had been dormant for 50 years, have been revived. Nowhere is there greater proof of this than in the former Yugoslavia. As the West rejoiced over the collapse of the communist bloc, nationalism became the defining political identity for many people, who got the signal that this was an acceptable and progressive force. By the way, we're going to be noting in, among other countries, Hungary, where Hungarian nationalists have begun to consider redefining the borders of Hungary and reconsidering those borders as defined by the end of World War I. Continuing. However, in all the celebrations of the victory of capitalism, the consequences of a revived nationalism were largely ignored. Fascism, an ideology fueled by nationalism, and one that had destroyed so much of Central Europe in the first half of the last century, was ignored. As the old order disappeared, so a new one emerged. The European Union, now based on the principles of free internal trade and movement and monetarist economic policies, has become the most formidable political and economic power in Europe today. Almost all European governments link their future economic well-being to membership of the EU. The emergence of the single currency, supported by most Western European governments, is pushing the continent ever closer to a United States of Europe. Whatever one's personal views on the single currency and the EU, huge dissatisfaction with the European project among a large swath of the continent's population has been grist to the already emboldened right-wing nationalists' mill in every country. In many countries, it is the nationalist right that has emerged as the dominant force in opposing the EU and globalization, eclipsing the position once held by the left. By the way, I would note that this has certain analogs in American political reaction, where the United Nations, among other institutions of international regulation, has been targeted by the far right or identified by the far right as an agent of world government, although the EU itself, or the European Monetary Union, is itself the realization of a long-held German nationalist concept, as we've seen before. I think that the EU as a political entity may very well serve as a coalescing force. Certainly it has served as a target. I think it is going to serve as a boon to Eurofascism. Continuing. As the nation-state becomes ever marginalized in financial, economic, and political decision-making, more and more people feel alienated from the political process. With almost all of the main political parties in Western Europe supporting the EU globalization project, many people, in a desire to retain an identity and a sense of control over their destiny, are turning to nationalism as a defensive mechanism. Compounding the process is the increasing alienation many people feel towards the political system, with conservative and social democratic parties throughout Europe submitting to monetarist economic policies in accordance with the strict EU criteria and World Trade Organization rules. Many voters are finding the two political traditions increasingly indistinguishable. To this must be added the rising political scandals and allegations of corruption that are tarnishing governments throughout the continent. From the sleaze-linked Conservative Party in Britain to the alleged French socialist funding of the German Christian Democrats to the allegations of fraud and tax evasion at the heart of the Italian Christian Democrats to the widespread corruption of the European Union itself, the political establishment throughout Europe is becoming more and more discredited in the eyes of a suspicious electorate. By the way, I would note that in Italy, the Clean Hands investigation was linked to Silvio Berlusconi in the P2 milieu, and yet the very corruption engendered by the P2 milieu helped to disenchant Italian voters with the political establishment. We're going to talk about that in the second half of the program as well. Speaking of political corruption and its effect in promoting fascism, the Searchlight editorial from the March 2000 issue continues as follows. Nowhere has this been more obvious than in Austria, where a large minority of the electorate became increasingly disillusioned with the Social Democratic Conservative coalition that had ruled the country for most of the post-war period, a coalition that had long been tarnished with the perception that it gave jobs to political friends. While Austrian history, nationalism, and social attitudes played a significant role in drawing support to Haider, it is important to place his achievements in a wider context. The lesson of Austria is a lesson for Europe. While quite rightly anti-racists and anti-fascists should be organizing and participating in solidarity actions with their counterparts in Austria, there is no room for complacency at home. Our task is to expose the far right as the enemy of national democracy, not its defender. I would note that in For the Record program number 217, the last program that we did updating our coverage of Eurofascism, we noted the profound role that anti-immigrant sentiment had played in the rise of Jörg Haider, and that has also played a very significant role in the rise of fascist political sentiment in other European countries as well. One of those is Denmark. That was covered in the Los Angeles Times of Friday, April 28th of the year 2000. This is an article by Carol J. Williams. It's datelined Copenhagen and headlined, Danes Cast Cold Eye on Immigrants. Subtitled, Denmark's Tight Controls Reflect Europe's Intensifying Dilemma. While industry sees an expanded need for skilled labor, nationalist appeals are closing doors. And this article also spotlights the conflict between the needs of industry for cheap labor and the desire for people in third world countries where the mere sustenance of a physical existence is becoming increasingly difficult, forcing immigration to industrialized countries where businesses are only too happy to take advantage of the lower wages that immigrants are willing to accept and because of the dire living conditions in the countries from which they're coming. Denmark is one of the countries that whose political electrical stability is being impaled on that particular spike. We're going to read about this, skipping down. Immigration has become one of the most volatile issues confronting the major European Union economies, as falling birth rates foreshadow huge labor shortfalls over the next few decades. A United Nations report last month warned EU countries that they face a choice between importing large numbers of foreign laborers and raising retirement age to 72 or older to keep enough people working to support the swelling ranks of pensioners. Germany and Italy face the biggest challenges in maintaining their populations and their economic power, says the report from the UN Department of Economic and Social Affairs. Spain and Britain also risk serious shrinkage without large-scale immigration. Throughout the 15-nation EU, an additional 1.7 million skilled professionals will be needed over the next 3 years to prevent the region from losing as much as $375 billion in commerce, London-based research firm Data Monitor concluded in a study from Microsoft. But the rise of the far right in Austria behind the xenophobic rabble-rousing of Jörg Haider and the soaring ratings of Denmark's populist Danish People's Party, European nations have been reacting to such forecasts with anguish and resistance. Skipping down in this LA Times story from April 28th of 2000, we read, even though Denmark's population is among the 10 richest in the world, according to most lists measuring per capita gross domestic product, the nation will have to import skilled labor from poor but computer-savvy countries such as India and Russia, or watch internet-driven commerce go elsewhere. Nowhere else in Europe has the anti-immigration rhetoric ascended to such heights. A small organization preaching multicultural tolerance mocked Danes' prejudices this year by erecting billboards that showed a black youth saying, "When I become white, I'll be a schoolteacher," unquote. Activists in the Danish People's Party responded with a parody showing a homeless white man saying, quote, "When I become a Muslim, I'll have a house," unquote, echoing the party's refrain that immigrants are edging out Danes for housing and social services. In what Danish Industrial Council Chairman Hans Skov Christensen denounces as feeding the inner pig dog of discrimination, unquote, some Danes of late have been demonizing the mere 2% of the population represented by racial and religious minorities. What was once considered ethnic slander now often passes unnoticed in polite conversation. Stein Carlsen, K-A-R-L-S-E-N, International General Secretary for the 350,000-member Union of Commercial and Clerical Employees, fears economic setbacks are ahead unless Danes get over their propensity for discrimination. Quote, "The language some people use today is very nasty," says Carlsen. "It's really something from the bottom, and it makes me both angry and afraid," unquote. The union has undertaken measures to fight workforce discrimination, which is blamed by all but the most strident nationalists for the high rate of unemployment among qualified immigrants, more than 60% among first-generation arrivals, in a country with only a 4% jobless rate, the lowest in the EU. But appeals for a loosening of the immigration restraints have only intensified the public outcry in long homogenous Denmark, which has maintained a ban on immigration since 1973. Skipping down again, Danish Foreign Minister Niels Helveg Petersen laments the success in February of Haider and the far-right Freedom Party in gaining a foothold in the Austrian government, but doubts Denmark will follow the same path. "Inevitably, there will be a need for us to become a more open society toward the outside world," Petersen says. However, Kjærsgaard's right-wing party insists that will never happen. Quote, "We don't believe in Denmark turning into a multi-ethnic society," says party spokesman Søren Espersen. "We have never been an immigrant country, and we will never be one." He takes heart from Danes' reaction to EU sanctions against Austria for allowing Haider's populists into the government. A poll by the Copenhagen daily Berlingske Tidende found only 30% of Danes behind the EU sanctions. Asperson contends that the clumsy, unquote, moves to punish anti-foreigner sentiments angered Danes, who are already skeptical about EU membership and the bloc's power to bully little countries about their right to decide such issues as immigration. And that obviously echoes many of the sentiments in that Searchlight editorial. By the way, the case guard discussed there is Pia Case Guard, KJAERSGAARD, of the Danish People's Party, which in many ways has an anti-immigration platform similar to that of Jörg Haider. Before we continue on to yet another European country's popular reception of Jörg Haider, we're going to turn now to rising fascist sentiment, or at least fascist terror, in another Scandinavian country, this being Sweden. This is from the Searchlight's issue of December of 1999, number 294, and this alludes to a wave of terror against anti-fascist activists in Sweden. This first article is by Stieg Larsson, L-A-R-S-S-O-N, in Stockholm. It's entitled Nazi Terror, Thousands Rally Against Killers, and it reads in part as follows. More than 8,000 people gathered at Stockholm's Citizens Square on October 23rd, that by the way of 1999, to protest at the murder a few days earlier of the trade unionist Björn Söderberg, that's S-O-D-E-R-B-E-R-G. It was Stockholm's largest anti-Nazi rally for 10 years, skipping down. In Gothenburg, almost 5,000 people heard 88-year-old Ingrid Segerstedt Wiberg, a legendary anti-Nazi fighter from the Second World War and a former Liberal Party MP, say that the Nazi threat had been ignored for too long. By the way, her name, Segerstedt-Wiberg. Continuing. 300 people gathered in Borås and another 350 in Trollhättan, where the fascist Sweden Democrats hold two council seats. Around 1,200 people turned out in the biting cold in Malmö, where the main speaker was Ingemar Simonsson, a retired priest and a target of Nazi death threats for several years. He told the rally, quote, "We must not forget that there is a brown, anti-Semitic tradition in Sweden with its roots in Germany of the 1930s, and I've noted in the past, including for the record program 217, of the strong historical and institutional connections between Jörg Haider and his Freedom Party and many of his political minions, and the fascism of the 1930s and 40s in Germany and Austria." Yet another article from the Searchlight's December 1999 issue about fascism in Sweden is the following article by Pat Hennings in Gothenburg entitled Nazi Sniper Targets Anti-Racist, and this reads in part as follows. The Swedish Nazi terror wave continued in early November with an attack on Kurdo Baksi, B-A-K-S-I, an editor of the Searchlight sister magazine Black White / Expo, when a bullet was fired through the living room window of his flat. He was asleep and was not injured. Skipping down. Black White Expo believes the attack was intended as a warning. It appears to have been a response to recent media debate on Nazi terrorism, in which Baksi has been prominent. He initiated a public solidarity meeting for the journalists whose car was bombed in summer and has repeatedly demanded tough measures against Nazi violence. The shooting occurred only weeks after the murder of Björn Söderberg, a member of the syndicalist SAC trade union. SAC was again the target for Nazi violence at the end of October, when a bomb blast rocked its local headquarters in Gävle, 200 kilometers north of Stockholm, on the evening before a nationwide protest at the assassination of Björn Söderberg. Skipping down again, by the way, his assassination was the focal point of the demonstrations that were alluded to in the previous article. And again, skipping down, the trial of three Nazis charged with a double police killing and bank raid began in early November. Andreas Axelsson, Tony Olsson, and Jackie Arklov are charged with a robbery in Malexander in May, which netted them £250,000 and ended in the execution-style murder of police officers Olof Borin and Robert Karlstrom. Mats Nielsen, a Nazi and convicted robber, Olsson's girlfriend Maren Andersson, and four younger local Nazis have been charged with aiding and abetting. And so note an upsurge in Nazi violence in Sweden, and note also, as indicated, similar political sentiments in Denmark as with regard to anti-EU and anti-immigrant sentiment to those which helped to fuel the rise of Jörg Haider in Austria. Speaking of Jörg Haider, Wolfgang Schüssel, the Austrian chancellor, has visited Hungary, where his visit has certainly cause some people to cast a jaundiced eye or a more jaundiced eye on Hungary. And note that Viktor Orban, the center-right prime minister of Hungary, has embraced closer political relations with or between Hungary and Austria, both, of course, part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. I would also note that Viktor Orban has been very receptive to pro-fascist sentiment in his own country, including glorification of soldiers who fought on behalf of Hungary and fascism in World War II. Hungary was part of the Axis in World War II. Of the closer relations between Austria and Hungary, which as a member of the EU is supposed to be ostracizing Austria, we read in the Financial Times of London of Friday, April 28th of the year 2000 as follows. This is an article by Robert Wright in Budapest. It's headlined, Austrian Visit Peaceful, subheaded Schussel in Budapest, Little Sign of Protests in Hungary. And this reads in part as follows. The first official visit to Budapest by Wolfgang Schussel, the Austrian Chancellor, passed off yesterday with little sign of the promised protests from Hungary's opposition. However, the country may yet feel the consequences of playing host to Mr. Schussel in what is only his second foreign trip since he formed a government in February with the far-right Freedom Party. Yesterday's visit was the culmination of a debate in Hungary over whether the country should follow member states of the European Union and seek to isolate Austria, or should Hungary, led by Viktor Orban, capital O-R-B-A-N, its center-right prime minister, follow what the government sees as its own separate diplomatic interests. Skipping down, the visit marks Hungary's second serious deviation from EU foreign policy under Mr. Orban. The government previously pressed ahead with negotiations on a free trade deal with Croatia under the late President Tudjman, whose government was politically barred from ties with the EU. In both cases, Hungary said its strong historic ties with the countries in question obliged it to maintain good relations. In numerous broadcasts interjecting, we've taken a look at the fascist antecedents of the Croatian government under Tudjman and its, in essence, recapitulation of the Ustashi fascist collaborationist government of World War II. The stance of Mr. Orban has been criticized in his own country as follows. Speaking, returning once again to the Financial Times of London of Friday, April 28th, this stance led István Szentivanyi, a member of parliament for the opposition Free Democrats, to accuse Mr. Orban of encouraging Hungary's own far right with his statements. And that is not the only thing that, the only types of statements that Mr. Orban has made. In For the Record program 217, we took note of rising fascist sentiment in Hungary, which was a member of the Axis in World War II. We're going to recap part of the article that we read in that particular For the Record segment, again, number 217. This from the Searchlight's issue of February of the year 2000. This is an article by Carl Pfeiffer in Budapest. It's called Hungary, Anti-Semitism on the Rise. And after noting the rise in anti-Semitism and anti-Gypsy sentiment, Carl Pfeiffer writes as follows. Hungary's Jews were, with the enthusiastic cooperation of the Royal Hungarian Gendarmerie, packed into cattle trucks destined for Auschwitz, all in a matter of less than 2 months. That, of course, referring to the World War II period. Continuing. In today's Hungary, apparently, such a deed must be rewarded. And so on October 19th of last year, a memorial plaque honoring these murderous thugs was unveiled by Zsolt Lányi, president of the Defense Committee of the Hungarian Parliament and a member of the Small Farmers Party, in the courtyard of the War History Museum in Budapest. If, 56 years after the breakthrough by the Red Army on the Don, it was possible to bring home the exhumed body of an unknown soldier, unquote, of the fascist Hungarian army, and rebury it with full military and religious honors, how long will it be before we see the rehabilitation of former premier and war criminal László Bárdossy, B-A-R-D-O-S-S-Y, who in 1941 introduced racist laws against Jews and dragged Hungary into the war against the Soviet Union? This necrophiliac unknown soldier ceremony was accompanied by a 12-gun salute and the peal of church bells throughout the country, while Prime Minister Viktor Orban said mournfully of the corpse, he has returned home with God's help, unquote. Orban's government enjoys the support of the right-wing extremist party of Justice and Life, led by the serial anti-Semite István Csirka, which has indeed called for Bárdossy's rehabilitation. Skipping down, this mood for rehabilitation of criminals pervades the political establishment. In the Education Ministry, among the pictures of former education ministers on display can be found that of Ferenc Rajnis, R-A-G-N-I-J-N-I-S-S, who held this post in Salazi's Arrow Cross fascist regime of World War II and was executed as a war criminal. What is lurking in the rooms of government ministries is also evident on the streets. The notorious forgery, The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, was published in Hungarian for the first time last summer and is on open sale at bookstalls in Budapest. It is not yet sold in mainstream bookshops, but the infamous Literature on the Jewish Question by yet another executed war criminal and book-shredding organizer Mihaly Kolosvari Borja most certainly is. And I would note that Hungary is not the only country where former war criminals and combatants on the fascist side are being honored. The same thing is taking place and has been for some time in Latvia, a former republic, of course, of the former Soviet Union. Returning now to the Searchlights issue of April of the year 2000, this is an article by Sam Vitovsky, V-I-T-O-F-S-K-Y. It's entitled Latvia, SS Jackboots Tramp Again, and it reads in part as follows. Veterans of the Latvian Waffen-SS marched through Riga last month, commemorating their first joint operation with the Nazis against Soviet troops 57 years ago. Around 4,000 ex-SS veterans and present-day nationalists marched under the flags of the Latvian Republic from the Dome Cathedral to the Freedom Monument, where they laid flowers. The march included 10 members of parliament, members of two nationalist parties of the ruling coalition, and the opposition Latvian Social Democratic Labor Party. This is the second time that former Nazi collaborators who were members of the entirely voluntary Latvian SS Legion, attached to the 6th SS Corps, have taken to the streets to commemorate Legionnaires Day. They marched for the first time in 1999 after Latvia's parliament had declared March 16th a day of remembrance for Latvian soldiers. On that occasion, the SS men were joined by the entire leadership of Latvia's armed forces. This year, the state did not mark the day officially as national and international protests pressurized the government into removing its official endorsement. Instead, the day of nationalist commemoration has been put back to November 11th to coincide with Lapleicis Day, L-A-P-L-E-C-I-S, which commemorates a national hero. A motion tabled by one of the nationalist parties, which called for a special parliamentary break for members to attend the march, was defeated by 84 to 27 votes. However, many believe the fact that the march went ahead at all is a mark of official sympathy, as the SS men continue to mark the occasion as Legionnaires' Day, unquote. Skipping down, Latvia's government has disgraced itself on several occasions in relation to the SS veterans. In October 1998, the parliament issued a declaration saying that Waffen-SS legionnaires were not Nazi bushers, but rather defended Latvia against resumption of the Stalin regime, unquote. In reality, there were two divisions of Latvians, some of whom engaged in mass executions, mainly of Jews, between 1941 and 1943, as well as police units that carried out atrocities against partisans and Russian and Belarusian citizens. So note that members of the voluntary Latvian SS Legion, part of the 6th SS Corps, have been marching to the accolades of members of parliament in Latvia and, in effect, being honored by elements of the Latvian government. So the past is being returned to in many European countries, at least to a certain extent. That concludes this segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.